On this edition for Sunday, July 25th, bipartisan infrastructure negotiations enter another week.
There are so many ways that infrastructure bill cannot work that nobody should assume that it's a done deal at all.
Jeff Greenfield with analysis and singer-songwriter Jackson Brown, next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, the Anderson Family Fund, the estate of Worthington Mayo Smith, the Leonard and Norma Chlorfine Foundation, the Rosalind P. Walter Foundation, Koo and Patricia Ewan, committed to bridging cultural differences in our communities. Barbara Hope Zuckerberg. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
For 25 years, Consumer Cellular has been offering no-contract wireless plans designed to help people do more of what they like. Our U.S.-based customer service team can help find a plan that fits you. To learn more, visit consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening and thank you for joining us. A big week for Congress, and the Biden administration is looming with decisions on infrastructure legislation and on the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. Today, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said she intends to name Representative Adam Kinzinger, a Republican, to the special committee investigating the Capitol riot and attack. Kinzinger is one of 10 House Republicans who voted to impeach former President Donald Trump. And the Senate may vote on a $1.2 trillion bipartisan infrastructure spending bill this week. One of the negotiators, Republican Senator Rob Portman, said today he believes one key issue remaining is public transit funding.
We're about 90% of the way there. I'm here this weekend working on legislative language with colleagues and with staff, and I feel good about getting that done this week.
For analysis on the week ahead on Capitol Hill, NewsHour Weekend special correspondent Jeff Greenfield joined us from Santa Barbara, California. Jeff, first of all, the past couple of weeks to try to keep track of these different bills has been incredibly difficult, not only parsing where the support lies, but what's in which one.
Let me take a shot at this. First is the bipartisan infrastructure bill. That would provide about $600 billion in new money for roads, bridges, rail, rural broadband, so-called hard infrastructure. That's the bill that a number of Republicans in principle have said they'd like to support. The other one is the much more ambitious $3.5 trillion Democrats-only bill that provides for social spending from pre-K to 2 years of free community college, vastly expanded Medicare for dental and vision services, help for childcare, help for seniors. And there's not a single Republican in the Senate who will support it. So you need every Democrat, and then Kamala Harris is the tiebreaker. So those are the two bills that are making their way or not through the process.
If on the bipartisan bill you get these 10 Republicans to sign on, is it a done deal? Do you have the 60 plus necessary to get this thing going?
I think there are more potholes than in the streets of New York, because this is the Congress you're talking about. You've got a couple of powerful Democratic senators who say, if our water projects are not in this bill, we won't support it. You've got a couple of Democrats in the House who feel aggrieved that they weren't part of the negotiations, and they're saying, maybe we won't support it. Just this morning, Rob Portman, one of the negotiators for the Republicans, is saying, I don't think I like the level of public transit money. So there are so many ways that infrastructure bill cannot work that nobody should assume that it's a done deal at all.
All right, let's talk about the big one, the $3.5 trillion one. In lots of ways, this is unprecedented. Why?
Well, it's always been my belief, and I think history confirms it, that the way Democrats have gotten big social programs was after they won landslide elections, Roosevelt in 1932 with the New Deal, LBJ with the Great Society. In this case, You're talking about what Bernie Sanders accurately calls the biggest social program since the New Deal, being passed in a 50-50 Senate. If it happens, it would be, as I say, absolutely unprecedented, but I wouldn't bet a lot on a result that winds up with nothing. You just don't know how this is going to play out.
Here we've got these two pieces of legislation, but put that in context of what we're living through now and maybe some of the consequences we haven't thought through.
Well, the first is COVID. If there is a resurgence of COVID, not only could it really hurt economically, but the whole sense of optimism we were seeing a month ago, we're out of this, I think will be replaced by, oh no, here we go again. And for an incumbent, you want an upbeat, buoyant country when the party's being judged in the midterms. The second one is this shortage of computer chips, which is worldwide and pervasive, has really put the auto industry on its uppers. You've got millions of orders, literally, that can't be filled, and you've got thousands of workers idled. If this keeps going, that's going to have a real impact on the economy, and it is not exactly politics 101 to say that an incumbent party facing bad economic times does not do well in the midterms.
Jeff, there's this movement now to take a closer look at the events of January 6th, and Nancy Pelosi has essentially kept some of President Trump's supporters out, and now she's saying she might let one of his detractors on the committee.
Two of the people that Kevin McCarthy wanted on that panel are the most aggressive deniers of what happened on January 6th. And along with Liz Cheney, Adam Kinzinger is one of the few Republicans who voted to impeach Donald Trump. So they may be Republicans, but this does not look like any more progress towards some kind of joint understanding, because the two parties have two very different views of this. And some of those Republicans' views, you know, it was a peaceful protest and George Soros and Antifa started it.
This week, we also saw several members of the Republican Party and even some members of Fox News change their messaging around vaccines. Will it work?
I think it'll work partway. It was really quite striking that you had what was a politically divided notion about vaccines like masks, which is really striking and unprecedented. And when you have the conservative governor of Alabama telling the non-vaccinated, this is your fault, that tells you that reality may be intruding here.
Jeff Greenfield joining us from Santa Barbara, California. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Iraq's prime minister says the country no longer needs American combat troop assistance to fight the Islamic State. In an interview with the Associated Press, ahead of his visit with President Joe Biden this week, Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi says the country will still ask for U.S. training and military intelligence help, but will no longer need combat support.
What we want from the American presence in Iraq is to support our forces in training, developing their efficiency and capabilities, and in security cooperation. The Iraqi army and security forces today are ready and capable of defending themselves.
In April, the U.S. and Iraq agreed to end the U.S. combat role, but did not specify a timetable for withdrawal of the 2,500 troops currently stationed there. Al-Kadhimi is scheduled to meet with President Biden at the White House tomorrow. Russia celebrated the 325th anniversary of the founding of its navy today. The annual naval parade featured dozens of ships and submarines on the Neva River in St. Petersburg. Troops marched and planes flew overhead as Russian President Vladimir Putin and military officials presided over the event. This year, the parade also featured ships from Iran, India, and Pakistan. At the Olympic Games, it was a day of firsts today. Some spoiler alerts ahead if you haven't watched yet. In swimming, Chase Kalis won the first American gold medal of the Games in the men's 400-meter individual medley, while the U.S. women won the bronze medal in the 4x100-meter freestyle relay. In gymnastics, the U.S. women's team finished behind Russia in its qualifying meet. The team is seeking a fourth straight Olympic gold medal and will compete again on Tuesday. The U.S. men's basketball team lost their opening game to France, their first Olympic loss since 2004. And in the newly added sport of skateboarding, Japan's Yuta Horigome won gold in the men's street skateboarding competition. American Jagger Eaton took home the bronze. For more national and international news, visit pbs.org/newshour. In the western U.S., the Dixie Fire, Northern California's largest wildfire, has destroyed more than a dozen homes and structures as it continues to burn throughout Butte and Plumas counties. Pacific Gas and Electric informed regulators that the blaze was sparked by toppled power lines and announced a plan to bury 10% of their power lines in high-risk fire zones. PG&E equipment has sparked wildfires before, including the 2018 Camp Fire, the deadliest and most destructive fire in the state's history. The company filed for Chapter 11 and last year emerged from bankruptcy, setting up a multi-billion-dollar fire victim trust for survivors. But an ongoing investigation found that while the fund has racked up millions of dollars in fees, many fire survivors are still waiting for compensation. I recently spoke with reporter Lily Jamali from NPR's California Newsroom and co-host and correspondent for the California Report about their investigation.
What we saw over the last half decade or so, as we really saw the impacts of climate change ramp up, we saw these fires sparking, and not just sparking, but growing to catastrophic proportions. So some of these fires were as far back as 2015, so 6 years ago, and the largest of the fires that PG&E caused were in 2017 and 2018. That last one was the Camp Fire, which you might remember ravaged much of the town of Paradise. It killed at least 85 people. It destroyed thousands of homes and left tens of thousands of people homeless. So almost as soon as that fire happened, PG&E filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. And what that did was it took all of these claims of 70,000 fire survivors and basically threw them into our nation's bankruptcy system. As a result of that, eventually PG&E and these fire survivors, through their lawyers, they struck a deal in late 2019 that called for a multi-billion-dollar settlement. But because half of that settlement is payable in the form of PG&E stock, now think about that for a second. You know, you lost your home, and now you are being asked to accept stock in the company that took your home or destroyed your life. That's the situation that many of these fire survivors are in. So they now hold, through this special trust that was created to distribute money to them, these fire survivors now hold almost a quarter of PG&E shares, 480 million shares of PG&E. Very challenging to liquidate that kind of stock quickly. And in fact, they haven't sold a single share. So that's largely why many of these fire survivors are still waiting for compensation from this settlement.
So this is 2 years, 3 years out. How are these people still managing to get by when most of them have not received a check?
Unfortunately, so many of them simply have not had the resources to move on, even now that we're approaching 3 years later. We are seeing situations where a number of people that I've personally met and correspond with all the time are still living in trailers and campers, really in temporary conditions. And when you see temperatures reach the triple digits, which they often do in that part of California, in the region we call the North State, it's really uncomfortable physically to have to endure that in a trailer, not to mention just having their lives be thrown into this limbo that has just continued on and on. I mean, we talk to people that are concerned about where their kids are going to go to school next year. They don't know, because if they're one of the lucky few that have gotten any compensation from this trust, they don't have enough to rebuild.
So what your reporting also found was that while so many of the victims have not yet been paid, or certainly not paid in full, that the administrators of the trust and the lawyers are getting paid their full rate.
Some of these numbers, Hari, are eye-popping. We have a trustee who's making $150,000 a month. A top claims administrator is making $1,250 an hour. There are a number of bankruptcy attorneys and financial advisors who are making $1,000 an hour or more. And I think what fire survivors are saying is, look, if you're going to spend that kind of money, we want to see results. And the truth is, when you look at the reporting that's happened, we don't know exactly which firms and which individuals are getting how much. Just even having that kind of transparency, I think, would go a long way. But these fire survivors feel like they have been burned on multiple fronts, you know, both in the fire itself, from many of them are upset with their lawyers for having agreed to this, what is clearly now a flawed settlement in the first place. And now they're having to deal with this administrative rigmarole without, you know, seeing the hard numbers of where every dollar that goes to those administrative costs is a dollar less for a fire survivor to rebuild their home, to move on. And so I think that that's where there's a lot of concern. After our report came out, there was a group of bipartisan group of state lawmakers here in California approached the attorney general and pointed to our story and said, you know, listen, you need to review the process of this trust, how it works, as well as what the fees are, because they're pretty exorbitant from what fire survivors think.
Lily Jamali, correspondent for KQED and NPR's California Newsroom. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Hari.
It's been 50 years since Jackson Browne's first hit, Doctor My Eyes, a song in which the world's troubles cause the singer's tear ducts to run dry. 15 albums, 8 Grammy nominations, countless benefit performances, and a slew of humanitarian awards later, Browne has just issued his first new recording in 7 years. Special correspondent Tom Cachato visited Browne in Los Angeles to discuss his new work and the themes and subjects he often returns to on his songwriting journey.
It's no surprise to learn from Jackson Browne that his new album begins with his telling listeners he's on a quest.
Still looking for something. I'm out here under the streetlight, baby. I'm still looking for something in the night.
The songs are about personal experience and about a search.
Searching is one of several themes he has pursued throughout more than half a century as a singer-songwriter. Though in one of his biggest hits, Running on Empty, he professed to be uncertain what he was looking for.
Many decades ago, you sang, I don't know what I'm hoping to find. And then you start off this record saying, I'm still looking for something. There's a relationship between Jackson of several decades ago and Jackson of today.
I think so. I think it's the same. I think in that respect, I'm more than ever trying to do what I was trying to do then, and differentiate between the world I'm imagining and, you know, the world I'm in.
His themes range widely. On his early albums, for example, he wrote a series of songs seeking meaning in the passing of friends.
I don't know what happens when people die. Can't seem to grasp it as hard as I try.
I mean, there was a review at one point, I think it might have been my third or fourth record, and the reviewer started the review by saying, has there ever been a Jackson Browne record where somebody doesn't die?
His new album is called Downhill from Everywhere, and it's filled with fresh takes on familiar subjects.
No longer need to tell them apart.
The man who once sang Doctor My Eyes now sings about his Cleveland heart. Inspired by an actual Ohio plant that makes artificial hearts, the singer imagines replacing his own vulnerable heart with one of those that can withstand the worst.
They never break, they don't even bleed, and they don't ache.
You know, you write in the first person a lot, and your songs, I think, lead one to believe you are the I in the songs.
Sometimes I sing you, and it's still I. You know, it depends on if I'm talking to myself, I suppose, or about myself. You know, it's like you have to interrogate yourself to get to the end of the song.
Browne has long put his lyrics where his beliefs are, singing on behalf of a myriad of causes, from Native American rights to Haitian earthquake relief.
The earth may tremble.
And he's an avowed patriot. He is, as well, a sharp critic of his country. In the 80s, for example, he notably opposed U.S. intervention in Central America. He's also a longtime advocate for clean oceans and against plastic pollution. The new album's title song asks that we consider our seas.
Do you think of the ocean as yours? Because you need the ocean to breathe.
Plastic is now completely clogging our waterways and filling up the ocean and also invading our bodies. You know, newborn babies are born with the chemicals that are plastic in their systems. You know, it's in the placenta, it's in the blood. So that's what I'm talking about, changing in time to do something.
In your writing, time is a theme. I don't know you well enough to say it's a preoccupation of yours, but you seem to have figured out very young that this game is rigged and you only get so much time.
Indeed, time fuels a sense of urgency in a 70s song called The Fuse. In the title song from a 2008 album, he sings, "Time may heal all wounds, but also time will steal you blind."
Time the conqueror.
And then in your song, Black and White, you're literally finishing the song and the record saying, "Time is running out, time is running out."
Time running out, time running out.
Maybe you could call it a preoccupation. I guess you could. It comes up a lot.
Time collides with another Brown theme, justice, on a song echoing America's current moment of protest and the activist group Color of Change. It's called Until Justice is Real.
And I just want to quote one of your lyrics. Time like a river, time like a train, time like a fuse burning shorter every day. In your lifetime, what do you think you're going to see in terms of the kind of justice you've been singing about these last decades and desiring?
Many of us believe that we are on a track going forward, that civil rights have improved, and you know, but nothing could be more obvious, and that's really not actually the case. We're still settling the Civil War. We're still talking to people who believe in white supremacy. They want to go backwards, and see, I don't really know quite how to say this. While I was thinking that we were getting somewhere, people were being ground up in the wheels of our society, and police were killing black motorists. There were injustices that went on and on and on and on, and that's what I'm saying. We don't have the time for these to go on and be swept aside. That's what the song is talking about.
Is justice going to win this race?
We could have a society in which justice is real, yeah.
And murder! And murder! And murder!
We have an opportunity to solve some of the problems that have beset our society and our country since its inception. The clock really is ticking, and you really have to, we have to join together to do that.
To watch Jackson Browne's entire exclusive performance of his song, My Cleveland Heart, go to PBS NewsHour's YouTube channel. Finally tonight, in South America, paleontologists announced that they have officially identified a 150 million year old fossil as the ancestor of current day crocodiles. The ancient remains may offer clues about how modern day amphibious crocodiles made the transition from land to aquatic life. A team from Argentina and Chile working together found the fossil in the mountains of southern Chile 7 years ago. On Friday, the Argentine Museum of Natural Sciences announced the skeleton as the grandfather of today's modern crocodiles.
200 million years ago, things were different. Crocodiles were small and they were terrestrial. They did not live in the water. As paleontologists, we always want to know what the transition was between those ancient, smaller crocodiles and the big modern ones that live in the water we have now. We were lucky to make a fabulous discovery in Chile in rocks around 150 million years old that show a little of this transition. This new crocodile we found is small, but it has aquatic habits.
Along with other fossil discoveries, this one supports the theory that South America was the cradle of crocodile evolution.
What it shows us is a series of unique features that no other crocodile has, because it was one of the first who started to enter into the water, fresh water. This crocodile combines primitive features and features we find in crocodiles nowadays, and it helps us understand how crocodiles became what they are now. How crocodiles can dive, how crocodiles eat, how crocodiles can live. This animal has certain characteristics about this particular transition.
The first crocodiles are believed to have emerged at the beginning of the Jurassic period, around the time of the first dinosaurs. Today, there are more than 20 crocodile species worldwide, including American alligators, found mostly in Florida and southeastern coastal states. Before we go, civil rights activist Robert Paris Moses has died. Moses worked as a field director for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and was central in leading voter registration drives in the South, where he was beaten and jailed. He also organized the 1964 Mississippi Freedom Summer Project, bringing white students from the North to help register voters and generate publicity to pressure Congress to enforce voting rights. In 1982, with the help of a MacArthur Fellowship, Moses founded the Algebra Project to help rural and inner city students succeed in math. The project reached more than 40,000 students in hundreds of schools nationally and won numerous awards. Moses' wife said he died this morning in Hollywood, Florida. There was no cause of death given. Bob Moses was 86 years old. That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. For the latest news updates, visit pbs.org/newshour. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and have a good night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, the Anderson Family Fund, the estate of Worthington Mayo Smith, the Leonard and Norma Chlorfine Foundation, the Rosalind P. Walter Foundation, Koo and Patricia Ewan, committed to bridging cultural differences in our communities, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by Consumer Cellular and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. And by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.